Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and New York State has a problem that it hasn't had in recent years, a big budget deficit. In other words, tax revenues are not keeping up with expenses. For most of their terms, Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio have had the luxury of strong tax revenues that have allowed them to expand services rather than say no to people or cut them. The politics of no are very different from the politics of yes. The governor gave his annual budget address this week, and the biggest headlines so far have been that he plans to close a lot of the budget gap by cutting state Medicaid spending, and he basically promised no new taxes on the wealthy. Let's take a closer look with WNYC, New York State politics reporter Fred Mogul, and Josefa Velasquez, Albany correspondent for the nonprofit news organization The City. Good morning, Fred. Good morning, Josefa.
Good morning, Brian.
Fred, why is there suddenly a budget deficit of about $6 billion for the next fiscal year? Isn't the economy about as good as it's been in other recent years?
Well, the economy is good, and these kinds of situations could always be worse. We should like pause for just a second and maybe tweak the language a little bit. Okay. We all do say deficit. It's sort of one person corrected me, said projected gap. Which is to say, we think this amount of revenue is going to come in. It's actually been coming in a little stronger, so that's good news. And this is what we want to spend on our wish list. We'd like to grow the government, 5% or more. Now, if we grow it less, if the revenues come in higher, then the gap somewhat closes. But we still have, they still have a lot of work to do. And Medicaid specifically is the biggest pot by far of that $6 billion projected gap. It's about $4 billion of it.
So just to follow up on what you said and be a little wonky, but I think people will find this interesting. If we're talking about a projected $6 billion budget gap for the next fiscal year, which starts April 1st, what is the total annual budget of New York State, roughly?
The total annual budget is about $178, $179 billion.
That's the current fiscal year?
That's for next year. So the current year is around, and Josefa can help me out here, but around 175, I think.
Okay, so we're talking about adding a few billion dollars for inflation or new expenses, and we're talking about a gap of about $6 billion projected out of about $175, $180 billion overall. Josefa, anything to add to why suddenly, at a time of, low unemployment and economic growth, there is a projected gap in revenues for a state government?
Yeah, so part of the $6 billion gap that we're seeing, a vast majority of that is attributed to Medicaid, which is the the insurance option for low-income people. The Cuomo administration has said that there are more people enrolling in Medicaid. New York's population is getting older and requiring more care. The cost of raising the minimum wage has also affected, how people who get paid via Medicaid, that balloons the budget there. And just
meaning health workers, people who work health sector, now eligible for the $15 minimum wage, which has taken full effect in New York State. Therefore, it costs the state more to administer Medicaid.
Correct. Right. And just the overall cost of providing health care has increased. So it's more and more expensive. And so that's why, out of that $6 billion, $4 billion of that, the Cuomo administration attributes to the rising cost of Medicaid and the rising enrollment in Medicaid.
So it is mostly more expenses as opposed to declining revenues.
Correct.
And your article is headlined, Cuomo's Recipe to Plug $6 Billion Budget Hole, Everyone Shares Medicaid Pain. Can you describe some of this pain-sharing plan?
Sure. So for those who were seeking to get firm answers from the governor on Tuesday on how exactly we're going to bridge that gap, we were left wanting a little bit more. The governor is reconvening a 9-year-old Medicaid redesign team to examine ways that the state can find at least $2.5 billion in savings. This team is going to get together and come up with a plan, basically, on how to cut Medicaid costs. We've seen the Cuomo administration already try to curb the growing cost of Medicaid by reducing payments by 1%, which happened on New Year's Eve. And that Medicaid redesign team has been charged with having zero effect on beneficiaries and zero impact on local governments. But while the governor's saying one thing, that this team should have zero impact, he's also proposing something that can actually really hurt local governments. And that has to do with the cap on Medicaid. So what the governor's proposing is to keep the Medicaid cap in place, so keep localities paying like a fixed amount towards the Medicaid bill. But if they go over that 3% cap that the state has put in place, then those localities are on the hook to pay the difference. So for New York City alone, City Hall estimates that it could be over $600 million last year.
Right.
And, we're talking about the increase, but the annual increase, the 3%. You're allowed to grow. Your costs always go up. They go up higher than inflation. But they can only go up. They're capped at 3% annually. Under this scenario, you get above 3%, you're on the hook. Now, the percentage in New York is much higher than the rest of the state. We're about on the order of 7 or 8%. We serve a lot more poor people. We have a lot more hospitals. They frankly charge a lot of money, so there are many reasons why that is. But if New York were to be penalized for exceeding that cap, it would be very, very expensive.
And Fred, I think a related piece of that is the governor says the state has been picking up all or most of these increases in recent years, and he says it's not fair to the state as opposed to the local budgets. And also, that status quo gives localities no incentive to be efficient in their Medicaid spending because Albany will just cover it.
Right, but there's a big debate here, and we're going to see this a lot in the coming weeks, as to how much localities can actually control the spending, the extent to which they are gatekeepers. He's saying they are, that they're letting in too many people, particularly in this very expensive long-term care, personal care, home care program, and that it's really up to them as gatekeepers to wrestle this back, have more stringent standards, enforce them, maybe fewer hours that people get care, hours per week, 10 instead of 20. So that's his claim. The localities claim, we really don't have that much control. You, the state, set the eligibility requirements. We're basically administering it, and have control over very little of this process. So the growth is not our fault.
And you bring up home health care, which is one of the great Medicaid benefits. Medicare, even though it's for the elderly, and that's who generally needs home health aides, does not cover home health aides. And so it tends to be, in terms of what the government covers, for poorer people who need help at home. And Josepha, Fred said that this idea is out there that maybe they can trim home health care expenses. Maybe people are being put into the system too easily or too many hours too easily for care. But I think the governor said he can make these cuts, these savings, without reducing benefits for Medicaid recipients. How explicitly did he make that promise?
So in terms of what he said, there's a lot of sort of gray area as to what he will do. The Medicaid redesign team, everything's being punted over to them. They're the ones that are going to decide ultimately what the state can do. The governor's budget director on Tuesday had hinted that they might look at who's eligible and what sort of requirements are needed to get home health care. There's, one program in particular that has ballooned over the last few years. The Cuomo administration pinpointed this one program, which allows consumers to basically direct their care at home and allow family members and friends to take care of them. And it seems that is something that could be on the chopping block. The Cuomo administration already tried to curb this program last year. and was ultimately unsuccessful. But the governor pinpoints the CDPAP program in his budget book as something that is ballooning in enrollment and ballooning in costs.
So, right. And those, just to clarify, those are consumer-directed care. That means if you take care of your aunt or your mother, you can actually apply to be paid for it.
Yeah.
But it's unique to New York, at least on this scale, and it's people don't really have their arms around it. The extent to which it's grown really under the radar. People I know who follow Medicaid, New York Medicaid, like a hawk, you know, are sort of aware of these general dynamics. It's not completely a surprise, but the specifics, they really don't feel like they have their hand on.
And talk about the rationale for that provision. I imagine it's something like, you know, everybody's time is worth something. It tends to fall on women who, when, let's say, an elderly parent gets sick, they take time out of the workforce to care for that person. And ultimately, that burden is unevenly distributed, and so they should be compensated. Is that, Josepha, I'll go to you on this. Is that basically the argument?
Yeah, it's a lot of women are taking these sort of jobs. A lot of immigrant women, in particular, have fulfilled this role as home health aides. And at this point, you know, we don't necessarily know the breadth of how big this program is. Mm-hmm. We understand that managed long-term care has skyrocketed. Enrollment in just that portion of Medicaid has really taken off in New York, and it's very expensive. You're talking about people who are disabled, people who just need, you know, possibly 24-hour care in their home. And this was part of a move by the Cuomo administration earlier in his tenure to get people out of nursing homes, which are very expensive, and let them be at home and get care at home, which theoretically should have been cheaper. People could have stayed at home where they're more comfortable and just have help there rather than go into a nursing home.
Is it not cheaper? Or are people arguing that it turns out not to actually work out that way?
Yeah, basically. It turns out that at the end of the day, because there's so many people now being enrolled in managed long-term care and having home health, you're not finding the savings that you would have initially thought.
There's about 6 million New Yorkers on Medicaid in general, roughly 1 in 3 New Yorkers. About 5% of this population is in these long-term care plans. They're responsible at this point now for about a third of the Medicaid budget. For a long time, we've heard, you know, 20% of the people with high needs are account for 80% of the cost, which is a dynamic that's still well in effect. But here you have a relatively small population, though very fast growing, that really is accounting for a large part of this, the increase in Medicaid costs.
And just if you know, so we don't put out inaccurate information about this relative compensation system, are there exclusions like your own adult children can or cannot get paid by the state to take care of you?
I think they can, but there is the eligibility is always complicated. I would just bring us back to that. This is Medicaid is for relatively poor and even working class people.
Right.
There are income cutoffs, so
right.
So it's not just your my relationship. It's what our income cutoffs are. Now for regular Medicaid, I believe they look at how much you own, your assets, and they look at how much you make. Regular Medicaid, they look back, I think, at least a year, and I've heard as much as 3 years. In this program, they look back only a month. So people can sort of move assets around pretty quickly and draw down, transfer what they have to family members and others. And so there is a way, it seems, that people are qualifying.
Let me just go back to that stat that you stated a minute ago, because I think that will surprise a lot of people. I didn't know it, and it surprised me. A third of the people in New York State get their health care through Medicaid, the government health insurance program for the poor. A third.
That's correct. We have about 20 million New Yorkers, and there's 6 million or so on Medicaid.
Listeners, we can take some phone calls, and we're going to go on to things other than Medicaid in Governor Cuomo's new projected budget. There are definitely other things to talk about. But this may not be as sexy as should President Trump be removed from office. But we are opening up the phones for your calls on Governor Cuomo's budget address this year and the New York State budget and the challenges that will affect many people's lives, as you've been hearing. For WNYC, New York State politics reporter Fred Mogul, and Josefa Velasquez, Albany correspondent for the nonprofit news organization The City. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So, Josefa, Mayor de Blasio has been calling for years, as you know, for a small tax increase on income over $1 million a year, just on that income, starting with the million and first dollar. Is that a non-starter with the governor to close some of this gap?
It seems like that's the case. Although we are facing this $6 billion budget gap, there was no mention in the governor's budgetary address about increasing the tax on the rich. The Assembly Speaker, Carl Hastie, is more open to that and trying to get more revenue into the state coffers via taxes on the wealthy. It seems that every year the mayor comes up to Albany, there have been different ways that the governor has tried to needle him. And it would not surprise me if this, again, will be a non-starter for the governor.
So when the governor hears, Fred, you're cutting health care for the poor while maintaining every privilege for the rich, even in this era of historically grotesque income inequality, what does he say?
Well, he didn't. His budget director actually did touch on this somewhat more directly than he did, and had a few slides about how much the wealthy pay for of our taxes. The top 1% already pays for 40% of the tax revenue. If you bring that down to the top 5 or 10%, you get to 50%, 2/3. So there is, he would say that there is a significant burden, and there he would claim that this is hotly debated. That there's some evidence that people are fleeing New York, and that we can't scare everyone away.
What about other revenue sources like legal recreational adult use marijuana, which he's proposing again this year? That comes with tax revenues, more legal casinos, or another kind of tax on the wealthy that's been mentioned, a pied-à-terre tax, they call it, on expensive second homes in New York State.
Relatively little of that pied-à-terre was not mentioned in the address, and I don't think it's emerged yet in the fine print. I mean, I think there will be some ideas like that. Certainly that will be part of what the Assembly brings to the table when they go into a room in March in advance of the April 1st deadline for the new fiscal year. We'll be looking at revenue raises. I should say, not to belabor the point on Medicaid, but one area where there was it went by very quickly. He did mention possibly raising industry revenues, which he said very literally very fast, raising industry revenues. We asked about that, if that could mean a possible tax on health insurance. The budget director said that's possible.
Let's take a phone call. Philomena in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Philomena.
Good morning. I wanted to challenge the point that was just made with respect to people, home health aid expenses not necessarily being more cost effective than putting people in nursing homes. Home health aides aren't making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year for sure. And home nursing homes in New York are $9,000 to $12,000 a month. How can they take a position that it's the reverse of what they previously thought? I don't understand that. What am I missing?
Can either of you get more granular on those numbers?
Sure. So as it turns out, it's not just people who are, or not just aides who are making the minimum wage, but it's also administering the program. There are these companies that are the intermediaries that do the administrative part of ensuring that people work X amount of hours doing the paperwork, and that all adds up. At the end of the day, these companies get reimbursements or payments from the state. So while someone might be making $15 an hour, it costs more to deliver care because there are different steps along the way that you have to pay the intermediary companies to administer the program. Then it becomes more expensive as it goes on.
Let's take another call. Julia in Bayshore. You're on WNYC. Hi, Julia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You've got a story for us, I see.
Yeah. So my mother had early onset dementia. And she endured that for 13 years before she passed this October. But the CDPAP program and Medicaid were really able to help us keep her home. If we weren't able to qualify for that program, she would have been in a nursing home, which also would have ended up costing Medicaid money. So we used that, and we actually hired certified home health aides to care for her in our house. So it was very beneficial for us.
And so the moral of the story is, let's not just talk about numbers. Let's talk about the human element here, how much more humane it was for your mother with Alzheimer's to be able to be, for you to be able to afford to take care of her at home as opposed to a nursing home.
And for myself, so we dealt with it ourselves. We managed it ourselves for the first, 10 years that she had it. I was able to take a leave of absence for a year and a half to care for her. But then that got too much on me and my family. I had to go back to work. And the only reason I was able to go back to work and not have to place her somewhere was because she qualified to have 12 hours of care a day, which she couldn't be left alone at all.
Julia, thank you.
It was necessary.
Fred, go ahead.
Julia, I'm curious how heavy the bureaucracy was, do you feel? Because it's my understanding that there's actually two levels of agencies. These companies, and then there's these fiscal intermediaries, and Josepha alluded to this, that the administration can be very expensive. Did you have any feel for that, either on the financial side or just on the bureaucratic paperwork side?
Yes, all of it. We had to go to an elder care attorney. We had to get money together to be able to get her to qualify for Medicaid in the first place so that she could get the care that she needed. And then I have such an education about it now, and I always reach out to people to say, let me help you, because I know so much now. But we used an agency at first. And the reason I switched to CDPAP, because the agency wasn't very reliable and they were sending different people all the time. And I was able to meet some great aides that were qualified and experienced and could be with her all the time. And I knew she was safe with people that I trusted.
Julia, thank you so much for chiming in with all of that. I think it's very useful for people to hear. And I'm really sorry about the loss of your mom.
Oh, thank you.
And let's go to a pharmacist calling in, Mike in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What you got?
Well, last year they passed a law that was supposed to limit PBMs in New York State, and it was supposed to save millions of dollars to
Now, PBMs are pharmacy benefit managers. You want to explain issue there?
Well, the issue is what CVS, Caremark, Express Script, Optima Rx, they choose what they want to pay to the pharmacy, and then they submit the bill to Medicaid. And if you Google today any news on the PBM scams and PBMs problems, state of Ohio found that PBMs technically scammed them out of millions and millions of dollars on spread cost. And they're kicking out PBMs out of the state altogether. New York State passed the law that was going to manage that. But Cuomo decided to veto it the last second without explanation why he did that. And that could have saved New York State millions and millions of dollars.
Fred, is this an issue you're familiar with?
I'm familiar with the contours of it, but I know it's come up a few times in recent years, different ways of sort of trimming the sales of the PBMs. But I'm not on top of where they are recently with the legislation. Josepha, do you know?
So my understanding is that the governor vetoed it, but it's going to be brought up again this session. It's something that is immensely sort of complicated. The governor vetoed it, I want to say, towards the end of December. So this is fresh on people's minds still.
It's that when we say pharmacy benefit managers, is that like if you have health insurance with a private company and it's, Cigna or whatever it is, you don't actually get your pharmaceuticals through them. You get them through Express Scripts or one of those other companies that's a lot of these subcontractor.
Right. There's a lot of – sometimes it's for optical or dental, but the biggest of these by far are the pharmaceutical benefits managers.
Yeah. And so interesting, Mike, as a pharmacist, I think was making the point, Josepha, that they actually help to save a lot of money. On the other hand, I think they frequently get ripped for being yet another unnecessary middleman, taking another bite out of the healthcare dollar for themselves and pushing up the cost.
Right, and the cost of medication, you know, definitely hasn't gone down. It's quite the opposite. It's skyrocketed. And this is clearly an issue. It's been around for a while. All different kinds of states are having this discussion over what to do with pharmacy benefit managers. And in New York, you know, I've been talking to Assemblymember Dick Gottfried, who chairs the health committee in the assembly and is represents Manhattan. And he wants to see the state Medicaid system as a whole start getting involved with pharmaceutical companies and trying to bring down drug costs. It's harder to negotiate when you're only representing, you know, 6,000, 7,000, 10,000 people, but when you represent 6 million people who are on Medicaid, there's strength behind numbers, and you could theoretically get costs down by negotiating with a larger, you know, percentage of people.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we have a few more minutes to talk about Governor Cuomo's proposed New York State budget for the next fiscal year, which begins April 1st, in light of the first $6 billion budget gap that we have had in a long time, that they're figuring out how to close between projected revenues and projected expenses. With WNYC New York State politics reporter Fred Mogul and Josefa Velasquez, Albany correspondent for the nonprofit news organization The City. We've been talking a lot about how much of the closing of this gap is apparently going to be on spending less on Medicaid. And I see the governor is planning to spend more money on some things, Fred, including $33 billion new dollars to fight climate change. Can you describe that budget item?
Yeah, no, a lot of that is money that's been in the pipeline. That's not all new money. That's okay. Some of it's been committed in years past, but there
total $33 billion.
Yeah, so
and that's not all in 1 year.
That's over 5 years at least. The different programs are spread out over different time periods. But that's a wide array of things. Everything from offshore wind farms to solar farms, massive batteries to store energy when the sun is down or the wind isn't blowing, electric vehicles to subsidize people to get more vehicles and get more ports around town. It also is about improving water quality and water infrastructure and fighting algae blooms upstate. So there's a lot in there.
And Josefa, what about infrastructure? The governor loves big infrastructure projects. And, you know, he's certainly got some on his radar. I know he wants to expand Penn Station. He still wants the rail link from LaGuardia to Willits Point, controversial in the neighborhood. Is anything like that in the budget?
So because we're sort of dealing with all these financial constraints, I think a lot of the big building that we're used to seeing from the governor sort of fell to the wayside, although there is still some money allocated to different sort of infrastructure projects. You know, you had mentioned the developing of Penn Station, having it be sort of newer and flashier. But in terms of like the big things that we're used to seeing, you know, like overhauling the Tappan Zee Bridge, we're not necessarily seeing such big ticket items this year.
Does that mean, Fred, that the rail link is dead or that the expansion of Penn Station is more talking point than reality?
Well, I think the rail link might be a little farther along, and I think it's too soon to declare it dead. I think he's fairly committed to that, but there's a lot to be worked out. The Penn Station thing is very much, you know, not even in its infancy, barely, you know, it has conceptual drawings, but it would take a lot of startup money just even to get the next set of real drawings.
Now, I'm confused about that because I know it's been in the news recently that the governor wants to expand Penn Station, including moving it, expanding it a block south of where it starts now, and the businesses that are there don't want that. Of course, they'd be forced to move or be bought out, and that's, nobody wants that if you're in that position. But I thought there was already a big Penn Station expansion underway for years and years, expanding onto the post office grounds across 8th Avenue, Moynihan Station, it was going to be called. Isn't that already happening?
Well, so he had a big presentation about this last month, kind of clarifying what that is and isn't. That is more about egress and ingress and moving people into a better waiting room and getting them in and out of the station. It is not actually an expansion of the station per se in the sense of tracks and platforms. It really doesn't touch that, apparently. And so that's what would be a lot of the southward
I see.
Movement.
Let me throw one other thing in that's not necessarily a budget item per se, but that would affect a lot of people. He said in the State of the State address, Josepha, that he would do something to improve the plight of gig economy workers, Uber and Lyft drivers, and people in other sectors who feel they're not being treated fairly. Has he gotten specific about any proposal for new workplace standards for gig workers?
Yeah, so in his budgetary address and in the subsequent budgetary legislation that comes out following the speech, the governor did address gig workers. He wants to create a task force or panel to come up with recommendations as to what to do about the gig workers. But it comes with, you know, a pretty major caveat. This task force needs to be in the state budget, which is due April 1, and the recommendations need to be acted on by May 1st. So that gives state lawmakers and the governor's office and all the various stakeholders only 1 month to figure out how to regulate the gig economy. And that's a really difficult thing to do in a month. And you add to that the fact that state lawmakers are on break in April. And so they're not in Albany. Not everyone is together in one room. So that makes it incredibly difficult to turn around on such a short time frame. You know, there's been other states that have passed measures to regulate the gig economy. California, you know, is the one that comes to mind. The most, and they have one bill out there to regulate like Uber and Lyft and what constitutes a contract or an independent contractor versus an employee. So again, this is all just proposals. At the end of the day, state lawmakers and the governor's office will have to come together and hash out the exact details of what they want to do. So that's something to keep an eye out for, especially in March as things start sort of coalescing and taking form. You know, how is the state going to regulate the gig economy? And what are the nuances of that and whether we're going to be emulating what other states have done?
Well, this is the interesting time of year for New York State politics. The New York State Legislature is only in session 6 months out of the year, and it's January through June. We remember how much got changed last year when Democrats had control effectively of both houses of the legislature for the first time, everything from bail reform to rent reform and lots of other stuff. So the big first bucket gets done by the budget deadline, April 1st. So we are in the thick of that right now. Another big bucket of things gets done from then until the end of June. So this is the interesting time with a lot of implications for our lives if we live in New York State for watching Albany. So we thank Josepha Velasquez, Albany correspondent for the nonprofit news organization The City, and WNYC New York State politics reporter Fred Mogul. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.